Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a White House aide testified yesterday to the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. We'll look back at what she said, about what the White House knew about the threat of violence that day and former President Trump's actions. First, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a New York state law last week that required people to show a special need to get a permit to carry a concealed firearm in public. In the 6-3 decision, the court's conservative justices said the right to bear arms for self-defense extends outside the home. The ruling left some states, including California and New Jersey, also working to replace similar laws with new public safety measures. We're talking about what this all means for our understanding of the Second Amendment and what states and local governments can and can't do. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that people should have the right to carry a firearm in public? If so, what would you like to see, if any, kind of permitting process issued by state governments, by local governments? Where do you draw the line on that kind of regulation? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Rubin is an assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. His work focuses on guns, the Second Amendment, and criminal law. His work was cited in the majority and dissenting opinions in this case. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, can you tell us a little more about what this New York law did and why the court's six conservative justices didn't like it?
Sure. So in New York State, in order to carry a handgun in public, you have to get a permit. And in order to get that permit, New York State, since 1913, has required that you show proper cause. And the way that that gets interpreted is by requiring an applicant to show a heightened need for self-defense, something that separates the applicant from the general public. In other words, saying that you just want a permit because you're worried that you might get attacked by a stranger and you want to have a gun for those random acts of violence in order to protect yourself is not enough in New York State. Rather, you need a particularized need that separates you from the general public, like that you've received threats of harm or that you carry a lot of money for your job or something along those lines. Back in the 1980s, most of the country either banned concealed carry altogether or had one of these New York style laws. But today, or at least before the Supreme Court ruling, New York was one of fewer than 10 states, albeit populous states, that had this sort of a policy. About 80 million Americans live in a place where in order to carry a concealed handgun, you need to show this heightened need for self-defense. And that's the policy, and the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional.
So let's look at the arguments from the majority. First of all, why did the majority say this didn't pass muster with their interpretation of the Second Amendment?
So the majority says that you have to implement the Second Amendment. You have to test whether or not gun restrictions pass the Second Amendment are consistent with the Second Amendment by looking at text and history. With respect to text, the Supreme Court said that there is a right to keep and bear arms, and to bear an arm means to carry it. And the court, the majority, says that it might be possible to restrict that right to carry a handgun, but in order to restrict it, you need to be able to point to historical analogs that are consistent with a modern day regulation. And by historical analogs, we're not talking about 100 years ago, after all the New York State policy at issue is from the 1910s, they're looking at whether or not there's a historical analog that goes back to the founding period. 1791 is when the Second Amendment got enacted, or into the 1800s and maybe up through when the 14th Amendment was passed in 1868. And one of the things that the court, the majority did, was they went through all these historical laws and they said that none of them were close enough, none of them were good enough to uphold New York's law.
What did the minority argue in response, the three justices who voted to preserve New York's law?
Well, the dissenting justices, in this case, was 6-3, as you mentioned, and in the majority were the six conservative justices, and in the dissent were the three more liberal justices on the bench. They took issue with this test to begin with. This isn't the way that individual rights traditionally or conventionally get implemented, ordinarily there is a consideration of whether or not a modern day restriction sufficiently furthers a sufficiently important government interest, and preventing gun violence is no doubt a compelling government interest. So they took issue with this approach altogether. They said it's an odd way to do constitutional law. And beyond that, they did their own historical analysis, and they thought that the analogs, the historical tradition of restricting guns in public that dates all the way back to the medieval times, is sufficient to uphold this good cause permitting law that New York State has.
Talking to Eric Rubin from the Southern Methodist University School of Law, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court ruling from last week overturning a New York law on concealed carry permits and the way they work. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about all this. That's 800-642-1234. What restrictions, if any, should states have when it comes to publicly carrying firearms? Are there restrictions you think are consistent with the Second Amendment? Call 800-642-1234. So, Eric, obviously this New York law overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, you mentioned a handful of other states with similar laws. Does this go beyond that, though? Does this call into question other gun regulations that aren't so specifically like this concealed carry permit concern?
Well, the answer there is yes. Now, to be sure, one of the things that the Supreme Court did say in its opinion was that the court was not calling into question permitting laws that have objective criteria for carrying a concealed handgun in public. So many states have so-called shall-issue permitting laws where you still need to get a license in order to carry a concealed handgun. But the government doesn't have discretion to deny the license based on your showing of some heightened need to carry a lethal weapon. So in places with these shall issue permitting laws, you might have to go through a background check and do some training, both in the classroom and also live fire. But you wouldn't have to convince a licensing official that you are in danger and that's why you need to carry a handgun. The court says, both in the majority opinion and the concurrences, they make clear that this opinion does not call into doubt those policies, which is somewhat interesting because there isn't a founding era analog to such licensing laws. But in any event, one of the things that the court did here, as I mentioned before, was it said that you have to adjudicate Second Amendment questions by looking solely to text and history. And that's a big change from the way that the lower courts have been deciding Second Amendment issues in the past decade and a half or so. So this will, in fact, affect other challenged laws, whether it's a ban on so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines or restrictions on people who are 18 to 21 possessing a firearm. This changes the way that those sorts of cases get decided. And over the past decade and a half, most challenged gun laws have been upheld. In other words, courts have been rejecting Second Amendment challenges by changing the methodology and requiring gun laws to be shored up solely on the basis of history. That is a change that will call into question all of these other laws that have already been deemed constitutional, and courts are going to be asked to take a closer look or another look based on this new methodology. Now, I should make clear that history is always important. It's important to all judges. Judges frequently will look to history when trying to understand what the Constitution means, but most judges don't think that that's the exclusive thing that should be taken into consideration. Modern day problems and modern day gun violence have also come into play when the lower courts have been deciding on the constitutionality of gun restrictions. But the court has said that that modern day violence is no longer relevant to the analysis.
We're talking to Eric Rubin, professor of law at Southern Methodist University, expert on firearm law, breaking down the U.S. Supreme Court ruling last week that struck down a New York state law that required proof of a special need before getting a concealed carry permit, finding out what that means for other kinds of firearm laws in states around the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision? If you've been looking at it, do you have questions about it and what it means for wider Second Amendment related issues? What abilities do you think states or local governments should have to limit publicly carrying firearms, to require permits? Call in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Eric Rubin. He's a law professor at Southern Methodist University, expert on the Second Amendment, looking at last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling expanding the right effectively to carry a gun in public as they overturned a New York state law requiring proof of a special need to get a concealed carry permit for handguns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear what you think about this? To what extent you think state or local government should be able to issue permits, to set expectations for permits for concealed carry? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Dick is with us in Brooklyn, the Wisconsin Brooklyn, not the New York State one. Dick, hi. He's not ready. Sorry. We'll get to him in just a minute. So before we do go to callers, then I want to talk about, you mentioned a couple times the last decade and a half of gun regulation. That's going back to the Heller ruling. Can you talk about what changed there?
Sure. So Heller, District of Columbia v. Heller was the 2008 decision where for the first time in the country's history, the Supreme Court declared that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms that is not centrally focused on the militia, which is the topic of the first half of the Second Amendment, but rather is at its core about private self-defense. The significance of this was that before that opinion, the consensus in the federal courts was that there is no Second Amendment problem unless a person who is challenging a law as it relates to service in a well-regulated militia. The Second Amendment provides a well-regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And that first half of the amendment, those 13 words about the militia, were seen as a limitation on the Second Amendment right. In 2008, the Supreme Court declared that those first 13 words are not a limitation on the right, that the right at its core is about private self-defense, and therefore a ban on handguns in the District of Columbia was unconstitutional. And that opinion, Heller, is still the lodestar Second Amendment opinion that has been guiding a wave of challenges to weapons laws across the country. That case, however, did not deal with the issue that was decided last week. It was about having a handgun in the home. Last week, the issue was whether or not you can carry that handgun into public spaces.
Let's go to our callers. Dick is with us in Brooklyn. Dick, hi.
Yeah, so I have a question regarding how far the law really goes. And I look at all this discussion about the ability to have weapons with high-capacity magazines, rapid fire. So where does it end? What if I want to put a tank out in front of my front yard because I want more firepower to defend myself? This is a rhetorical question, obviously, but I like your opinion as to where does this end?
Dick, thanks for the call. Yeah, arms covers a lot of ground from, I guess, a knife to a nuclear weapon. There's a line. I think there's always going to be a line there somewhere, Eric.
Yeah, and this was a topic that wasn't at issue in this case, but it's a good question. It's one that's it's been litigated in the past and it will continue to be litigated. Obviously, at the time that the Second Amendment was enacted, firearms were by and large muskets. They were muzzle loaders. They took time to load. They were inaccurate. You couldn't carry them around loaded because they could misfire. Technology has advanced a great deal. So the courts have to decide as a threshold matter what counts as an arm. And most of the courts that have considered the issue have said that machine guns, for instance, simply are not covered by the Second Amendment. Fully automatic weapons simply are not covered. Now, semi-automatic weapons like AR-15 style guns that have been used in recent mass shootings, that's a closer call, though the consensus in the federal courts thus far is that it's constitutional to ban them. And it's also been the consensus that it's constitutional to ban large capacity magazines. In terms of a tank, my guess is that courts would universally, under whatever test you wanted to apply, say that you have no Second Amendment right to have a tank in your front yard because that is simply not what we count as an arm. Now, one question that's open after this opinion last week is whether this consensus about AR-15 style weapons is up for grabs. And I think in that respect, it's worth noting that the Supreme Court is holding four cases right now. We're gonna find out on Friday whether or not it will be hearing any of these cases next year. And three of them deal with either assault weapons or large capacity magazines. So maybe in answer to Dick's question, next year we'll find out just how far the court is going to go in this regard.
Dick, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dianora joins us now in Racine. Hello, Dianora.
Hi. My question is, I know that they talk a lot about these gun laws, but the real problem is all these criminals that have guns, they will always be able to get guns. How are they going to take care of that?
Dianora, thanks for the call. Eric, questions, I think, about the effectiveness of gun laws, people willing to break the law, willing to get guns. Does that kind of consideration factor into a court's decision?
Well, one justice in particular seemed very concerned about this. Justice Alito wrote a concurrence where he painted this picture of New York City that made it look sort of like Gotham from Batman, where people are constantly carrying around illegal guns and the bad guys have guns and the good guys need to have guns. New York, of course, contests that depiction. It's one of the safer large cities in the world right now. But the point is well taken. It's possible to illegally carry guns, and a lot of people do it. So what do we do about that problem? I think that it's a challenging problem. There's a black market for guns out there. And one of the reasons why there's a black market for guns is because there are roughly 400 million in the United States. And guns are finding their way into inner cities, into the hands of dangerous people with criminal convictions who otherwise shouldn't have them. Now, to be sure, it doesn't matter what law you're talking about, what crime you're talking about. There always are people who are willing to commit it. Even though we prohibit murder, people still commit murders. And so just the mere fact that people are going to violate the law is usually not a good enough reason not to have the law in the first place. And I think that one of the goals with respect to keeping the firearms out of the wrong hands is to make it as hard as possible for guns to find their way into the black market and to get into those wrong hands, such as by expanding background checks and the like.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Eric Rubin from the Southern Methodist University School of Law, looking at the latest Supreme Court ruling on gun laws, a concealed carry law in this case in New York State. Eric, four states that require a permit for concealed carry. You mentioned they can do background checks. That seems to be constitutional still. What kind of restrictions can they have? If we find X in a background check, it is we can say no to your concealed carry application, and it's still constitutional for us to do that.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that you're going to see states do now, especially policymakers in these affected states, is look at the existing restrictions on licenses that go beyond this heightened need for self-defense and make sure that they're optimal for the changed circumstances. I think that in places like New York, this need to show a heightened self-defense, that requirement, was really the teeth of their restrictions. New York State, for instance, unlike many other states, did not require permit applicants to take any concealed carry class or to show any proficiency with a firearm in the range. There was no training requirement under New York State law. And that's because so few people could actually get through this other requirement. So tomorrow, New York State is actually calling back a special session of the legislature to consider changes to try to shore up their law. I expect that in addition to the background checks, you'll also see some sort of training requirement. I also wouldn't be surprised if policymakers look at so-called no-gun zones and sensitive places. The court has made clear that it's not calling into question whether or not you can ban guns entirely, whether or not you've got a permit from certain sensitive places like schools and government buildings, courthouses, polling places. And that list of places that the court has provided us with is not exhaustive. So I'd expect that there's going to be more attention on trying to carve out no gun zones, but we'll see what else happens when legislatures convene to try to optimize the law under these changed circumstances.
Did I see, when it comes to those no gun zones, did I see that in Justice Thomas's statement on this, that he said, yeah, you could still have gun zones, but don't push it. Don't use no gun zones to completely restrict people's ability to carry arms, carry arms?
Yeah, that's it. And I think that this is just anticipating the next wave of cases. We'll see how far places like New York are going to go. At oral argument, there was talk about whether or not you could ban guns in Times Square on New Year's Eve or on the college campuses of NYU or other universities, in subways. So I think that one of the questions is how far can you go? Clearly, you can't declare all of New York City to be a gun-free zone. But what happens if you say you can't bring a gun within 1,000 feet of schools, for instance? That would carve out a lot of New York City. And would that go too far in the court's eyes? I think that the court probably doesn't want to become like a zoning commission for gun carry. But after this decision, they might find themselves in that position.
Briefly, as we wrap up, you mentioned some cases maybe hitting the Supreme Court. What is there one in particular you're watching for?
I'm watching three cases that deal with either large capacity magazines or so-called assault weapons. And these cases, which are out of New Jersey and California and a couple other places, the court's been holding on to them now for weeks and weeks, and they're going to issue their final orders, I'd expect, this Friday, just in 2 days from now. So I'll be looking to see whether or not they remand those cases for further consideration after this Bruin case on public carry, or maybe they'll take one of them. It'll be really interesting to see what they decide to do for next year. And if they decide to take one, I think that is a pretty big signal that this court is going to be taking a lot of Second Amendment cases in the coming years.
Eric, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Eric Rubin, assistant professor of law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. He talked with us about last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling striking down a New York gun law and what it means for the rest of the country. Coming up after the news, we'll look back at yesterday's testimony from a White House aide about former President Trump's actions before and during the January 6th attack on the Capitol. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, like it or not, bugs are all over the place, crawling through our lawns, basements, and even our culture. A Wisconsin entomologist celebrates the relationship between bugs and human art. Now, the House January 6th committee called a surprise session yesterday. The witness was Cassidy Hutchinson, a former White House aide who worked for former President Trump's last chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Hutchinson's testimony included, among other things, telling committee members that then-President Trump wanted to lead the crowd to the Capitol and that he was aware that his supporters in the crowd were armed before a speech in which he told them to fight like hell. We're talking about yesterday's January 6th hearings, what we've learned thus far, and what could come out of it all. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the testimony from yesterday, to the whole sequence of events so far? What do you think as you look back on January 6th, 2021? What questions do you still want to see answered? Who do you want to answer those questions under oath? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alisa Von Hagel is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin Superior. Alisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into yesterday's hearing in particular, big picture, what have you made so far of these January 6th committee hearings?
Well, I think these hearings have been really different from hearings before. They've really done a very purposeful job of each particular day's hearings having a message, a beginning, middle, end. There's, you know, not the grandiose political speech making that often happens that takes up a lot of time, but it's very clear, direct to the point, and it paints a really clear and stark picture of, you know, what it is that the message is that they're trying to send about one particular facet of this larger set of issues that they are investigating.
They sometimes read, and some other political scientists have mentioned this, like a prosecution in some ways, but this is, of course, not a prosecutorial body. What do you see as the, I guess, intended audience of all this? The public, the Justice Department, who?
I think all of the above. I think primarily they you know, the intention is to ensure that the American people are informed, are aware of the, you know, the incredible investigations that they have done, all of the documents, you know, the phone records, testimonials that they have gone through for months and months, and to provide a very clear and definitive picture of what happened. Certainly, I think you're also correct that it's also, you know, whether or not they decide to make a criminal referral to the Justice Department is yet unclear, but certainly that they will be painting a picture, you know, with that in mind, clearly, as the hearings continue to, you know, set the stage for a very clear, definitive reasoning behind a referral if they intend to do so.
Now, turning to yesterday's surprise hearing, there wasn't one planned originally. There weren't going to be any till after the July 4th holiday. They added this one with Cassidy Hutchinson, not a household name until yesterday, I think, a former aide, a deputy to then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Can you help us understand the value of her testimony and her perspective?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, to anybody who heard any part of her testimony or read anything about it, it was really stark, very shocking, truly shocking for even amongst, you know, well-seasoned politicos who have seen and, you know, heard everything under the sun. I think that yesterday's testimony was, you know, jaw-dropping, which I think I read in multiple places in different news articles. And so she was an aide, so she had the, you know, a window into all of the goings on behind the scenes in the White House. She was interacting with all of these major or top staffers that we hear a lot about, but have most of them anyways, have thus far not met with the committee for a hearing or for a testimony. And so she was able to give kind of that, the big picture look, but also exact examples, even speech, even, you know, comments that people made to kind of fill in the gaps that were still, I think, left with before her participation.
And she was careful, I think, to say, you know, when she was there first person hearing something from someone versus she heard somebody else say this about something else. I want to turn to one of her, what she presented as a first person experience. This is just before former President Trump's speech at the Eclipse in D.C., saying that the president was aware that members of the crowd had weapons. Here she is talking about that.
I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here. Let the people in. Take the effing mags away.
The mags being magnetometers used as weapon detectors in this case. Elisa, people have pointed toward this as arguably the most significant part of that, the idea that the president was aware that at least some of the people gathered were armed before he sent them to the Capitol, saying they should fight like hell. That's been interpreted as, you know, political speech, you know, fight for what you believe in. The suggestion that the president was aware of weapons, though, why is that getting focus?
I mean, I think that's crucial to the overall picture of what they're painting about the event. But also with that particular scenario that she addressed here, but also with other examples of interactions with other top staffers, it was clear that, you know, the president, the former president, as well as his staffers knew that January 6th had the potential to become violent. And this particular example on that day where he clearly had, you know, known that there were people with the whole array of weaponry that people had assembled and wanted them to continue on to the Capitol was, again, reinforcing this larger, you know, idea that they had known well in advance that this could be violent, and that almost it seems as if, or implies as if, that there was an intention or purpose behind that in terms of letting them go through to the Capitol with all of these weapons.
Talking to Elisa von Hagel from UW-Superior, political science professor there, looking at the latest testimony in front of the January 6th Commission in the U.S. House. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, or reactions. That's 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to another moment yesterday. Hutchinson said that White House counsel Pat Cipollone was worried about the president breaking the law even before January 6th. Here's Hutchinson.
Please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol, Cassidy. Keep in touch with me. We're going to get charged with every crime imaginable if we make that movement happen. In the days leading up to the 6th, we had conversations about potentially obstructing justice or defrauding the electoral count.
So she was quoting there Pat Cipollone at the outset. Concerns raised before January 6th about people involved in the efforts on January 6th risking being charged with various crimes. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So there have been a number of different potential crimes that would be in play with this whole, you know, these whole events. And as she noted, the obstruction of justice, attempting to conspire to defraud the electoral count is, you know, this would certainly be an indication that there was, you know, an attempt to obstruct the process by which the Congress was, you know, supposed to be conducting during that time period. And so if, in fact, the president was, you know, not only well aware of this, but also planning on marching on down to the Capitol himself to be present at this event, it seems to provide that it would provide intent, which is necessary for this obstruction charge to have any merit in a court of law.
We're talking to Elisa von Hagel about highlights from yesterday's January 6th hearings and what we've learned so far in the series of hearings. Elisa is a political science professor at UW-Superior. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the hearings? What are you still hoping to hear? What do you hope, if anything, comes out of all of this? Or do you think it's time to be done? Yesterday in particular, what stood out to you in Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony yesterday, a deputy to then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk about yesterday's January 6th hearings, where new details were revealed about what Trump officials knew leading up to the attack. We're covering some of the key points with Elisa von Hagel, political science professor at UW-Superior, and you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions, and what you want to know. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. I want to talk about kind of shifting attitudes, Elisa, toward the events of January 6th from in the moment to now, especially from House Republicans. Just that they played a couple clips yesterday that spoke to the immediacy of the event, I think. First of all, I want to give a listen to Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy talking to CBS on January 6th, 2021.
I completely condemn the violence in the Capitol. What we're currently watching unfold is un-American. I am disappointed. I'm sad. This is not what our country should look like. This is not who we are. This is not the First Amendment. This has to stop, and this has to stop now.
And Mike Gallagher, Republican congressman from Wisconsin, put out a statement in the midst of the events on January 6th.
Mr. President, you have got to stop this. You are the only person who can call this off. Call it off. The election is over. Call it off. This is bigger than you. It's bigger than any member of Congress. It is about the United States of America, which is more important than any politician.
Elisa, how has the conversation changed since the midst of those events and the urgency we just heard there?
I think that there has been a subtle shift with these hearings. While certainly, you know, the ardent supporters of Donald Trump are, you know, less inclined to agree with or believe what is being presented as of right now. But there has been a subtle shift in terms of the acknowledgement of the events of what had happened. The committee, beginning with the, I believe on the day one of the hearings, airing the footage from the Capitol, footage that has yet been unseen, and really illustrating very clearly, point blank, to the audience of the extreme violence that had occurred, really helps to deflate the, you know, the arguments that, you know, it wasn't a violent incursion or insurrection. It was simply, as you know, was mentioned, a First Amendment attempt at political speech. And so with all of these things coming out, there is slowly and, you know, surely this chipping away at the arguments that this event has not been violent and with the intent to overturn American democratic procedures.
Let's go to our callers now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. Your guest referenced a part of what my question would be. I'm wondering for the ardent Trump supporters, if there is any data accumulated yet as to if they believe the content of the hearings, and two, if they do believe it, if they don't care.
Tom, thanks for the call. Elisa, I don't know that this is necessarily moving the needle for one group or another.
Correct. And that's a very good point. And I think both are perhaps simultaneously often the case true, that either it's just simply rejected outright, or while at the same time, a lot of times these statements or claims or even evidence that's presented, it's just simply do not care. And it's really unclear, again, how much of that base, that, you know, strong support base that he has remains and how much has shifted. But certainly his polling has continued to decline over time. And so, even for a post-election anyways. And so perhaps there is that slow chipping away. But I do agree with the caller that both of those scenarios is often the case.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We'll go to Jim now in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I believe this is just another political game, much like the Russian collusion thing. It's really not sinking into anybody out here in the real world. It's just terrible that, they're just worried that Donald Trump will win again, because right now the Gallup poll shows he would win against Biden in a matchup, even now, after all the slander, after all the abuse he's taken in the media. And I think it's just an effort to keep him from not winning, or anybody else that's, you know, like him, to win the election, because they know it's inevitable.
Jim, thanks for the call. Elisa, what do you think?
I heard Adam Schiff, who's a member of this committee, in an interview just recently, and he had stated that, you know, the purpose here for him was about American democracy. And, you know, and maybe this is, you know, grandiose, you know, speech making, of course, but that the intent was to ensure that our democratic procedures, which, you know, very well may be threatened in coming elections, are precious, are critical. And it is critical for the American public to be informed on these matters of what has just happened, so that it doesn't happen again. And certainly, you know, there's obviously, you know, thinking forward to the midterm elections, that could very well be part of it in terms of the hearings themselves. So there's multiple, I think there's multiple reasons behind the decisions to go ahead with the hearings on the part of the committee itself.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Elisa von Hagel, professor of political science at UW-Superior, looking at the January 6th commission hearings, including the one yesterday. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Katie is with us now in Hudson. Katie, hi.
Hi. Say, I want to hear more about something that was brought up at the debate when Trump responded to a question about the Proud Boys. And he said, Proud Boys, stand down, but stand by. I want to hear if there is any evidence or connection that they have been colluding about this for some time.
Katie, thanks for the call. Elisa, a number of members of the Proud Boys have been charged, some convicted, related to January 6th. Do you see the commission looking for connections between the president, some of his closest advisors, some in the war room at a nearby hotel, and groups like the Proud Boys?
I do think that in terms of the top staffers, particularly, as you mentioned, at the Willard Hotel meeting the day before, that there were interactions amongst people who were at the event themselves who were part of, you know, creating this violence, and with, you know, White House officials is, you know, documented, is clear. Whether or not Donald Trump himself personally, whether there's evidence if he himself was involved in, you know, interacting or, you know, talking about this upcoming event, it's unclear at this point. However, it is clear that there has been connections between White House staffers and some of these leaders in Proud Boys, Oath Takers, and others who were taking part in the insurrection.
Katie, thanks for that call. Rob joins us now in La Crosse. Hi, Rob.
Hey, my comment is basically echoing a caller from before. I'm a Republican, and I was disgusted by seeing the violence on TV against everyone involved. But the most important thing is that I believe it's a what's happening is a kind of a charade in terms of the what the Democratic Party is not doing to actually address what is important and what America cares about. I really feel like what they're doing is not sincere. And I'm tired of everyone who's a Trump supporter being called a white supremacist. I mean, would Democrats want to be called homosexuals or whatnot every time they're referenced? That's all I have to say.
Rob, thanks for the call. Rob, seeing this as a distraction in some ways from big issues, Elisa.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, I think the persons on the committee are very aware of this, you know, potential criticism before, you know, planning and orchestrating the event itself. And so that is why I believe that the, you know, the hearings themselves were, you know, not simply a reiteration of what people already have known, but it's, you know, certainly these events are things that are known about. However, the evidence, the witness testimonials, the documentation involved is something, you know, that they have presented, that they have collected and analyzed as a committee, is something well beyond what, you know, what has been known previously. And so they are very, you know, conscious of this, you know, criticism. And clearly the, you know, the hearings themselves were put together in such a way as to illustrate that it is much more than what has been commonly, you know, reported upon or talked about in the media about the events of this time.
Time for one more caller. Bill is with us in Cameron. Bill, hi.
Hello. Yes, this is Bill. Previous callers have talked about CARE, some referencing CARE of the Nation about this issue. And then another one thought that it's just no difference, that only a Republican president needs to come in and correct things. And I'm sorry. I mean, I was around when Nixon pulled his junk. And I, at that time, had supported Nixon, and I was shocked that something like that could happen. More conservative people in my atmosphere also were shocked. And now the nation is in a different state. People are not shocked at this stuff. I have supported Republican presidencies somewhat until recently, when there's too many lies going on and too many believing falsehoods.
Bill, thanks for the call. We're just about out of time. Elisa, is there something different now? We're less we're less able to be shocked, as Bill says, than we were in the times of Nixon.
I think to a certain extent, yeah, there has been indications that, you know, a lot of these things that would be, you know, jaw-dropping scenarios are just simply, you know, brushed over for the next news event of the day. And so whether it's a product of this time or, you know, any one particular person, it's unclear, but certainly it is a different day and age, certainly.
Thanks to everyone for calling in. And Elisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I've been talking to Elisa von Hagel, professor of political science at UW-Superior. She joined us for a closer look at yesterday's January 6th hearings, how they fit into the overall pattern of the hearings so far. None now until after the July 4th holiday scheduled by the January 6th committee. We'll watch for that schedule and share it with you when we know when we're going to be airing those. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. A lot of people are dealing with autoimmune disorders, and they can be difficult to diagnose and treat. Find out what causes them and hear about the latest research. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. And you can find more great conversations about health on the Central Time archives. I just heard yesterday about the latest in migraine research, very common condition, maybe affecting you or someone you know. And another great conversation on gut health a couple weeks back. Find all of this stuff at WPR.org. I've shared a couple pieces of dog-related news lately. The winners of the Westminster Dog Show and the World's Ugliest Dog Contest. Here's something a little more scientific, though. There's been a long debate over where dogs came from, as in where and when they were domesticated. There's agreement they most likely came from gray wolves, and it started at least 15,000 years ago. But some evidence points to East Asia, some to the Middle East and nearby. As reported in the New York Times, a new study of wolf genetics says the reason it's all so confusing is it may have happened twice. The genetic study used 72 ancient wolf genomes. It points toward two different domestications that turn wolves into dogs, once in Asia, once in the Middle East region. This is not a done deal in the scientific world, but it looks possible that humans asked wolves, "Who's a good boy?" and got an answer two separate times and places in human history. This is Central Time.